Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Buddhang dhammang sanghang namassami. So we now come on to chapter 8 of this collection of Lumpur Sumato's Dhamma teachings. This is volume 3 of the anthology, and these talks come from the book This Is the Way It Is, which is mostly Dhamma talks that Lumpur gave on a retreat here at Amravati, a winter retreat of 1988. And this talk is called This Is the Way It Is. This is the way it is a skillful reflection. Venerable Buddhadasa Bhikkhu, the renowned Thai sage, said, "If there was to be a useful inscription to put on a medallion around your neck, it would be, 'This is the way it is.'" This reflection helps us to contemplate, wherever we happen to be, whatever time and place, good or bad, this is the way it is. It's a way of bringing an acceptance into our minds, a noting rather than a reaction. It's also notable that Ajahn Buddhadasa, just like Venerable Ajahn Chah and many of the forest Ajahns, were very critical of the obsession with medallions or the sort of superstition around wearing medallions, amulets, protective tattoos, and so on and so forth that were and continue to be a very strong part of the Thai religious world. And so the Ajahn Chah spent a lot of time discouraging people from trusting in medallions, amulets, and such like, and saying it's far more trustworthy to keep the five precepts, take refuge in Buddha, Dhamma, Sangha, and to practice meditation. That's the kind of thing that really protects us. So both he and Ajahn Buddhadasa were quite outspoken in terms of criticizing the use of amulets. And so this particular comment that Venerable Ajahn Buddhadasa made was saying, in the light of there is one medallion that will be useful to you. There is actually one, but it would have to have written on it the words, "This is the way it is." Then the medallion, the amulet, would be very, very helpful for you, because it's giving you good advice. It's a reminder that is very much in accordance with Dhamma. And I believe the Thai for that that phrase is Benyang Ni Eng. Benyang Ni Eng, this is the way it is. The practice of meditation is reflecting on the way it is, quote unquote, in order to see the fears and desires which we create. This is quite a simple practice. But the practice of Dhamma should be very, very simple rather than complicated. Many methods of meditation are very, very complicated, with many stages and techniques, so one becomes addicted to complicated things. Sometimes we don't really know how things are because of our attachment to views. However, the more simple we become, the more clear, profound, and meaningful everything is to us. For example, consider the people here, the monks and nuns we live with. Maybe we feel attracted to some, we feel averse to some, we sympathize with some, we understand some, we don't understand. But whatever view we have, we can see it as just a view, quote unquote, of a person rather than a real person. We can hear ourselves saying, "I don't want him to be like that, I want him to be otherwise. He should be this other way, he shouldn't be like this." "I want it to be otherwise," quote unquote, is the whale of the age. That's whale, W-A-I-L, not the big creature that lives in the sea. Whale as in a kind of a cry or a loud, say, comment based on a kind of anguished feeling. That is the wail of the age. Why can't life be otherwise? Why do people have to die? Why do we have to grow old? Why this sickness? Why do we have to be separated from our loved ones? Why do innocent children who wouldn't hurt anyone in their lives, old people who wouldn't hurt anyone, have to suffer from starvation or brutality? There's always some horrible new thing happening. The other day, someone wrote to me about the Bangladesh Muslims trying to get rid of Buddhist hill tribes in the Chittagong hill tracts through genocide. Then we hear about Iranians trying to eradicate the Baha'is. It goes on endlessly. There are always clashes between groups, one trying to take over another's land or power. This has been going on since who knows when. Someone has always been trying to exterminate someone else since Cain murdered Abel. And that was a long time ago. But each time we hear of these atrocities, we say, how terrible, it shouldn't be. We hear about American drug companies selling poisonous and horrible drugs to the third world countries. That shouldn't be, it's dreadful. The pollution of the planet, the despoiling of the environment, the killing of dolphins and whales, where does it end? What can you do about it? It seems to be an endless problem of human ignorance. At a time when people should know better, they're doing the most horrendous things to each other. It's a time of gloomy predictions. Earthquakes, volcanic eruptions and diseases. It shouldn't be like this. Note that this was 1988, so that was a long, long time ago. So more than 30 years ago, but still the same kind of difficulties and issues predominate the world. And things have not changed a great deal in that respect. Saying, this is the way it is, quote unquote, is not approval or a refusal to do anything, but a way of establishing oneself in the knowledge that nature is like this. In the animal kingdom, it's very much a question of survival of the fittest, a natural self-selecting law where the weaker strains are destroyed, so that in that way, even nature is quite brutal. We think of nature as being everything it should be, sweet with flowers and sunshine, but nature is also very brutal. What is our position in nature? We can live on the level of the animal kingdom, with its emphasis on the survival of the fittest, the strong over the weak, and living by fear and power. We can live like that, because we share that animal mentality. We have an animal body, and it has to survive like any other animal body on this planet. So the law of the jungle is something human beings can subscribe to, and many of them do. But this is only a lower level. If we live on just that level, we must expect the world to be as it is, a state of fear and anxiety. But as human beings, we can get beyond this animal level. We can decide to have some kind of moral standard to abide by, so that we don't have to live our lives in a state of anxiety. Oh, this is a very important aspect of this teaching, and I emphasize this over and over again. When we talk about, say, this is the way it is, it can seem like a what they call a fatalistic attitude. So it can seem to imply that you're not going to, do anything in terms of relieving the starvation or difficulty, that you're not going to work against the brutality of human tendencies and such like. So it's very important to understand that this kind of reflection of this is the way it is accepting, but it's not approving. That acceptance and approval are not the same thing. So that similarly, accepting that nature is brutal, it's a kind of a fight for survival on a daily basis, and that in much of the animal world, it's that way, and so that is part of the natural order. Violence and selfishness, destructiveness is part of nature. But what Lumpur is pointing to here is that one of the great blessings that we have, the incredible opportunities that we have in the human birth, is that we can do better than living according to animal instincts and just being guided by competition and, say, using the might is right ethic, we can be guided by compassion, we can be guided by wisdom, we can live according to the moral principles of the precepts. We can do that. We can live in a more, say, skillful and a more harmonious way, a way that is going to be leading to greater benefit for ourselves and the beings around us, a way of life that is based upon appreciation of the feelings of others. In the animal realm, a predator like a shark or a blackbird. A blackbird, I would suggest, can't think compassionately about the worm. You know, when it's looking for food, it hears the sound of a worm in the ground and it picks a worm out and pulls it out of the ground and eats it. A shark looking for something to eat, a seal or fishes in the sea, the shark it doesn't have compassionate thoughts for the things that it's eating. It's just driven by those powerful instincts. As human beings, we have those same instincts of just sort of taking what we like because we want it and we need it. But we have this much greater range of appreciation, perception. We have a mind that is far more attuned to a greater degree of appreciation for the different levels of reality, as it were, so that we can put ourselves into the shoes of other beings. We can appreciate what it's like for those that we share this life with, and we can be guided by attitudes of kindness, compassion, unselfishness, non-violence, honesty, and these wonderful values that make it much easier and more, say, comfortable and supportive for us as a human family. We can do that. So in speaking about, you know, this is the way it is, it's a sense of attuning the heart to, in nature is this way. And so that's sort of part one. Here it is. It's like this. Part two is the therefore. And because we have spiritual qualities as a human being, we can tap into the attitudes of kindness, compassion, sympathetic joy, equanimity, the Brahma Viharas. We can come from a place of wisdom and unselfishness. Then having accepted, okay, this is the way it is in this moment, part two is then, therefore, what's the best thing to say? What's the best thing to do? What's the best way to relate to this present moment experience in order to bring about the greatest benefit for this being and the beings around us? And so that quality of attunement, that quality of acceptance, its partner is the appreciation, the intuitive wisdom that recognizes this is wholesome, beneficial, this is supportive and encouraging, this is destructive, this is selfish, this is painful, this is divisive. And so then it's that recognition of the difference between the wholesome and the unwholesome. That's an intrinsic part of mindfulness and wisdom that is naturally and necessarily a part of it, so that it's not in any way does this appreciation or this point of view of, you know, this is the way it is, it's not encouraging a passivity or a sort of dissociation from the living world and from our own life, our own mind, our own body, and the world around us, but rather it's a radical attunement that then leads to skillful action. And so often I feel that when we reflect upon the Triple Gem, when we take refuge in the Triple Gem, in a way the Dhamma is the root, the Dhamma is the substance of reality. And then the Buddha is the primary function of that of the Dhamma, that the capacity to be awake, to know, to be aware, that is the function of Dhamma. And so when the awake mind knows the way things are, sees the way things are, then what results from that is sangha, is the representation of the inclination towards that which is wholesome, that which is beneficial, that which is noble. So when the awake mind sees the way things are, what arises is skillful action, wholesome action. And so that I feel is one way of reflecting on the triple gem, and also pointing out how the natural result of awakening, of attunement of the heart to its own nature as Dhamma, the natural result of that is a life given to being a benefit and to acting and speaking in ways and cultivating attitudes that lead to the greatest benefit possible. Any questions, thoughts on that before I continue? It's Gaspar.
Thank you, Ajahn. I feel these are very important considerations to have. And as you were speaking, I was just reflecting upon the quality of nature itself, in a sense that from my observation, nature is rarely wasteful in any way. Most of the processes that happen have a clear sort of goal. And going back to sort of evolutionary psychology, whatever is happening with a goal to sort of advance the organisms to increase their fitness so that they are stronger and they are able to sort of replicate, etc., and survive. But then on the other side, so that sounds like a wholesome thing, like a wholesome quality of the nature. It is helping the organisms to propagate. But the flip side of this process is obviously there is brutality in that sense. And so I wonder, you know, when I think of nature, I think of a sort of a thing that we can draw inspiration from. But what doesn't compute in my mind is, where does this brutality then come from? Because yes, we as humans, we have the capacity to choose otherwise. But as you said, a shark seldom contemplates when the belly is empty whether or not to open the mouth or not. So if you can reflect on that, thank you.
Yeah, well, the word nature is, it's like, it's a simple word, it's a short word, but it encompasses a great range of qualities. And so you could say that the enlightened mind is an aspect of nature, and the weight of the electron is an aspect of nature, from the most sort of basic physical qualities to the most sort of exalted spiritual dimensions. These are all part of the natural order. So I would see that, you know, with the aspect of brutality, you know, if you look at our going to evolutionary psychology, you know, for the first billion years of life on Earth, as I understand it, they were just the kind of monocellular, not even cells, the prokaryotes, the kind of primordial lifelike objects that multiplied in the seas and the warm tide pools of the planet. For a billion years, 1,000 million years, that was as evolved as we got. And then over the next, say, 400 or 500 million years, then they got to be single cellular life and then multicellular life. And then the competing for resources, even in the monocellular creatures, even before animal life had evolved, then it was who's going to get the resources, and the ones who get the resources survive, and the ones who don't get the resources don't. It's almost like a physical process. It's a chemical process. There's not a lot of refinement in that. And I think animal life evolved about 600 million years ago, if I'm remembering my evolutionary biology correctly, probably not. But about 600 million years ago, then animal life and sexual reproduction developed, and then whoomph, you know, the whole evolutionary process ramped up a great deal. There was lots of oxygen around, and the whole system developed. But even so, it's still not much above a sort of chemical reactive process. It's not very refined. And so what we're a part of, our physicality, you know, our bodies are made of atoms, you know, neutrons and protons and electrons and different elements, different molecules. And so that, and then the kind of biological processes that make up our bodies are also based on very, very ancient processes, just like the mitochondria that fix the oxygen from the atmosphere. They are direct descendants of the blue-green algae, you know, back in those warm tide pools hundreds of millions of years ago. That's the very thing that gets the oxygen from the air and keeps our bodies alive. So that we inherit, as human beings, a huge amount of that sort of physical and basic biological processes. But as nature, as part of the natural order, there's the increasing qualities of organization. And what we're a part of as human beings is this evolution to the point where nature can know itself. That the universe can be aware of itself, at least to some degree, and that is, I wouldn't say that's an end point, but we are the pinnacle of the evolutionary process, not at all. But we can see with great enlightened beings like the Buddha that there is a potential that is there within this living system, within the natural order, whereby not only can nature evolve to the state where it can know itself, it can contemplate itself, like as a human being, we can contemplate the nature of life and the universe and the world around us. We can do that, but also not just contemplate it, but we can develop a quality of understanding and a mental development and maturity to the point where this life is completely in harmony with that natural order, and the experience of that living process is one that is completely sort of pleasant, joyful, and liberated, which is what we call enlightenment. So that we have, in at least within this human realm, in this Buddhist tradition, we have the exemplars of the Buddha and the great enlightened beings that are there. This is the potentiality that we can see for the natural order. This is possible for us. We still experience the results of our ancestry, like we have to breathe. You know, I'm really glad those mitochondria are doing their thing. We can breathe, but we also have the remnants and the forces of competition. You know, this is my space. Get out of my space. You know, this is where I belong. You don't belong here. What are you doing in my place? or sexual desire. The desire for food when we're hungry, and the social dominance, you know, who's senior, who's junior, who's older, who's younger, who's more powerful, who's less powerful. We experience the results of all of those sort of ancestral qualities that are functioning through us. But I feel what is so brilliantly and beautifully articulated in Buddha Dhamma is like, yes, we experience greed, hatred, delusion, we experience these ancient instincts, but we don't have to build our life around those. We can do better. We can cultivate the Brahma-viharas. We can live a life based on loving kindness, on compassion, on sympathetic joy, on equanimity. We can live respecting the lives and the well-being and the feelings of other beings. That's something that we can do. And so, like within Buddha Dhamma, the fact that the first precept for lay people, you know, the Buddha's guidance is, you know, panatipata, you know, to not take the life of any other breathing thing, to any other living creature. It's like that's a laying out as a way of conduct that gesture of respect, that we don't have to kill other things. We can live without doing that. Now, let's give that a try. Let's put that in place and see what the result of that is. So that, to me, the process of spiritual development and what we have in the Buddha's teaching and this Buddhist practice is a way of doing everything that's possible to help to help nature evolve to its, say, to the point of self-realization, to where nature can know itself. And in that knowing, the experience is one of great peacefulness, of great freedom, and great ease, and what we call enlightenment. Beyond, what there might be beyond that, or if nature is capable of evolving to greater degrees or beyond that, or that's just sort of stage one out of a 100-stage process, okay, I don't know. But what we have is, I feel that the set of skills and traditions and practices and a living situation that helps nature, the nature of what we are and what we're a part of, to evolve to the to a very high degree of its own potential. I wouldn't say it completely fulfills its potential, and I wouldn't be so conceited to say that. But if we take say the full enlightenment as the consummation of the human potential, at least as a working model, then I feel that's the best we can do with our human life, and that is a skillful direction to set. So that, you know, the Buddha talked about the Eightfold Path. A path is a track that's going in a particular direction. It's what they call teleological. There's a point, an end point, and that it within this teaching is what we call the Dukkha Nirodha, the ending of suffering, or we talk about enlightenment, Bodhi. So that the path is leading towards the end of suffering, towards enlightenment. That's where it's going to. So that gives us a very clear direction in terms of where evolution, where what's the best direction, or what's the most skillful direction for nature to evolve or to develop. It's not to have sharper teeth or bigger claws or to, you know, outcompete other entities for territory. It's for this spiritual potential that's what's laid out within the Buddhist tradition and the Buddha's teaching. And so that of all the things we can do with our life to develop physically or mentally, intellectually, or in terms of impact on the planet or gathering resources, there's all kinds of ways we can spend our time and what we can do with our energy of a human life. But the Buddha's advice is, well, this is the best thing we can do with our lives, and to try it out and see what happens. That was a long answer to your question, but there's a lot there. So, okay, to continue. So we don't have to live our lives in a state of anxiety. But even higher than that is our ability to realize the truth, to contemplate existence, to cultivate the reflective mind through which we can transcend personality. At the level of moral behavior, we still have a very strong personality view, and in our civilization, we've developed a sense of me and mine to absurdity. So strong is this sense of me and mine that it seems to dominate everything and taint everything we do. And there's always a sense of anguish and suffering connected with it. Contemplate that whenever there's a sense of me and mine in anything, it always seems to give rise to discontentment, uncertainty or doubt, guilt, fear or anxiety. There is this view of me as an individual being, that this is mine, that I should or shouldn't coming from a belief in oneself as the body or mental conditions. However, this view is based upon an illusion. It comes from conditioning, not from insight. So as long as we identify with the limitations of the body and the mind, then of course we're going to experience doubt, despair, anguish, sorrow, grief and lamentation, these mental forms of suffering. How could it be otherwise? We're certainly not going to get enlightenment from distorted misunderstanding and wrong view. We have this opportunity now to establish right view and right understanding, which free us from the personality illusion, identification with what are called the five khandhas, body, feeling, perception, mental formations and consciousness. So we contemplate consciousness through the senses, the eye, ear, nose, tongue and body. We can contemplate mental formations, the yesterdays of our own creation and the thoughts and views that we create. We can see them as impermanent. As I was quoting a few days ago, one of the comments that Lumpur would often make is, whenever I think about myself, I feel depressed. And that is a direct connection. When the mind creates the eye sense, ahankara, the eye-making habit, mamankara, the mind-making habit, ahankara, mamankara, then that is a direct cause of dukkha. As soon as the mind takes hold of that, I am feeling, this is me, this is mine, this is what I am, right there, there's the cause of dukkha and a sense of alienation, because then I am, therefore there is other. And there's a sense of alienation, of separation and insecurity, and then wanting to protect ourselves from the threat of the other in some way, shape or form. And so that capacity to contemplate existence and to see how that sense of I and me and mine is based on the repetitive and varied way that the mind identifies with the five khandhas. This is my body. I'm a woman. I'm a man. I'm old. I'm young. I'm tall. I'm short. This is my nationality. This is my age. This is my personality. This is my story. This is my role in the world. I am this. This is me. This is mine. Whether it's something positive and colorful, glamorous, something that's painful and criticized, that's unfortunate or difficult, or just neutral. You know, I'm a completely average person. There's absolutely nothing distinctive about me. I'm a completely ordinary bloke. That's exactly what I am. Even ordinariness, that manyati, that conceiving that the mind attaches to the I am in these many and various ways. There's a matrix of qualities called the nine types of conceit that the Buddha highlights or outlines in the Nidesa, and he says, if you're the best and you think you're the best, if you're the best and you think you're average, and if you're the best and you think you're the worst, that's conceit. If you're average and you think you're the best, if you're average and you think you're average, if you're average and you think that you're the worst, that's also conceit. If you're the worst and you think you're the best, if you're the worst and you think that you're average and you're the worst and you think you're the worst, that's conceit also. The nine types of conceit. So whether it's accurate or not, if you think you're the best and you are the best, that's a conceit. If you're the worst and you think you're the worst, that's a conceit. So any I am-ing, all of that is manyati, is conceit, conceiving, and is necessarily productive of dukkha. So that it's in our practice and in development of the meditation, then a lot of it is to do with recognizing that eye-making and mind-making habit, that's getting to know that. You can't just decide for it not to happen. Like we were talking about instinct, Gaspar's question about nature and evolution. You know, we have very, very powerful instinctual forces that say, "Yeah, I am. This is my body. Ow, it hurts." Or "I'm hungry." Or "I need fresh air." Or "I'm hot." Or "I'm cold." Or "This is my space." You know, all of us are the recipients. You can't just switch off those instinctual forces just as an act of will, but they can be recognized. And this is the great potential that we have, the great opportunity that we have in terms of developing Dhamma practice, is we can develop that skill, the mind that recognizes, oh, here's the I am taking shape, rather than I'm hungry, or here's the feeling of hunger, it's like this. This is the way it is. Or here's aversion, here's criticism and complaining, this is the way it is. Rather than I'm complaining or I'm criticizing, or I shouldn't be criticizing. There's the mind creating I shouldn't. That's what's happening. And so this development of insight into what the mind is doing and training it not to see in terms of self-view and other, but to just be, oh, this is the way it is. This is what hunger feels like. This is what anger feels like. This is what contentment feels like. This is the, yes, finally, I've got it right feeling. That's what that is like. This is the way it is. Helps the mind to see the patterns of nature, those patterns of experience, as they are, without any kind of creation of that as a permanent individual entity, not creating a person out of it. As Lumpo says here, you know, this view is based on belief in oneself as a body or mental conditions. However, this view is based on an illusion. It comes from conditioning, not from insight. As long as we identify with the limitations of body and mind, then of course we're going to experience doubt, despair, anguish, sorrow, grief, and lamentation. So that might not be immediately obvious, but the more that we practice, we can see how that connection works very simply and very directly, that the more that the mind sees things in terms of nature and natural order and doesn't take things personally, then the more there is that, even though, say, physical pain or being cold or hungry, being lonely or feeling like you've done something stupid and you're being criticized because of that stupid thing that you said or did, those are still uncomfortable states. It's still, hungry. You know, the belly is growling, hungry. It's still uncomfortable. It's still, if you injured your knee, then it's still painful. The pain is still there. But the essence is that the mind is not making a problem out of it. That second arrow is not being allowed to land. And so that the flow of experience, the patterns of seeing, hearing, smelling, tasting, touching, remembering, imagining, and so on, they arise and take shape and pass away, but the mind isn't creating that into a person. And as I like to say, that which knows the person isn't a person. And even if that's hard to appreciate, I like to use that way of reflecting, that which knows form is formless. That which, say, like right now, looking at this microphone and the camera and the temple and the people gathered here, hearing the visual forms, the physical forms of the pillows and the floor and the camera and the microphone, the book, that which knows the forms, the visual forms, is formless. The quality of awareness has no form. That which knows the sound of these words, that knowing which appreciates the form, the structure of sound, the different pitches and tones and the meaning that the word carries, that the words carry, that which is aware of those forms is formless. It's not formed. It doesn't have a structure. So I feel that reflecting in this way, it feeds that realization of the unborn, the unoriginated, the uncreated, the timeless, that which is aware and awake, that which is, say, the essence of mind, if one can use that kind of a term, that quality of awakened awareness. It receives and it knows the world, but it's not limited by the world. And that's why liberation is possible. And a few days ago, we were talking about the impact of the Dhamma talk that Lumpo Cha received from Lumpo Muan when he was visiting him way back in the 1940s. And it was when Venerable Ajahn Mun, Lumpu Mun, said, you know, that quality of awareness, the puru, is transcendent of the five khandhas. That which knows the five khandhas is not limited by the five khandhas. That's why liberation is possible. If every kind of knowing, every kind of awareness was part of the five khandhas, liberation would be impossible. But because that which is aware of the five khandhas is not attached to them, is not bound by them, is not a part of the five khandhas, therefore liberation is possible. So I feel in terms of our practice and using the retreat time that we have here and the meditation, just even if it's hard to get a feeling for that, to get the mind around those principles, just remembering those words, repeating them to yourself, you're writing them down or taking them to heart, that which knows the person isn't a person. That which is aware of the five khandhas transcends the five khandhas. Then just picking that up, reflecting on that, letting that soak in, then seeing how that has an effect on the way that we appreciate this body, this mind, this personality, or that which knows masculinity isn't masculine, that which knows femininity isn't feminine, that which knows the world is not a part of the world, that which knows the realm of time and space and individuality is not bound by time or space or by individuality. Just dropping that kind of suggestion, that possibility of seeing things in that way, then slowly but surely there's a change of view, a change of perspective that can take shape. So any questions, thoughts, reflections on any of that? Yes, Anagarika Evgenia.
So basically we can say that because of this kind of two direction, one is animal and one goes beyond this kind of separate self that has to survive in any way. That's why so many practices are going against this flow that I have to be not feeling hungry, like having my space, and all difficulties that practitioners go through, like all these kilesas, that kind of burning heart that is so difficult to go against. This is this kind of reptile brain that basically you go against this very deep nature. And you kind of see this mind kind of burning, trying to make you like obey.
And make you what?
Obey, like follow. Mm-hmm. And you just have to observe and see it kind of crying and asking for something, but kind of be firm, knowing that you can go beyond it.
Yeah, one of the ways that in the forest tradition we talk about the practice of Dhamma is called the suffering that leads to the end of suffering. You heard that expression before? So, yeah, it's you feel the burn, as it were. Yeah, there's a burning, you know, you find yourself longing for something, longing for food or to travel, or longing for a partner, longing for something or anything, and that meeting of those longings or those that kind of frustration, that's a lot of the skill of the practice in this tradition, in this way of spiritual training, is meeting that kind of burn. That friction, and understanding, well, this is where it comes from. Because of birth, then there's a body, there's a mind, and there's a lot of habits that say that they rejoice in having my own space, or rejoice in having food when I'm hungry, or having companionship, and that there's a lot of conditioning around that. And so in order to so fully understand this human condition and why we were born and the effects of having been born, that needs to be met. You can't just sort of suppress that or just pretend it's not there or just get away from it, because it doesn't work that way. And so meeting those forces of aversion, of territory, of desire, of jealousy, of competition, and fear, and so on. It's so much of the practice is about skillfully meeting those. So it's called the suffering that leads to the end of suffering, because you're choosing it. It's like you're asking for this. It's like you've booked an appointment for the dentist, so you know it's going to hurt and be messy because that's what trips to the dentist are like, you know. So that you've asked for it, and you know that like a trip to the dentist, it has a purpose. There's a point to this difficulty and this, say the need to endure in a skillful way. So just like when you're sitting in a dentist's chair and you're trying not to make a problem out of it, and the drill is going away, you know, sort of boring away, and it's there's bits of shocks of pain and discomfort, but you're training your mind not to react, just to be with it. At least that's how I try to operate, function when I'm in a dentist's chair. Similarly, when you're in the monastery and using this environment. That's the spirit of it, is that by deliberately turning towards that difficulty, and you're ready to meet fear, aversion, loneliness, restlessness, desire, and to say, here it is, it feels this way, this is the vipaka, the resultant karma of having been born. There are these forces, these feelings. And they can be known, they can be understood without suppressing them, without following them. They can be known, and it feels like this. It's this way, so that there's friction there. It's a burn. If I'm understanding what you're asking, and so that's not a sign that anything is going wrong. If you come into the monastic life and think, this is all about the ending of suffering, so it should be comfortable all the time. It's like, you joined the wrong team. It doesn't really, usually it doesn't work, pretty much always it doesn't work that way. But it's like we're choosing to undergo a particular kind of training, and there's going to be discomfort or difficulty in that. And that by recognizing that, it's like if you're joining an athletic club or a hiking club, and that if you want to climb the mountains, you've got to climb, you've got to carry a pack, you've got to make the legs and the lungs work, because if you want to get up the mountain, that's what you've got to do. Or if you're joining an athletic club, if you want to get fit, you've got to do a lot of running, you've got to train yourself, you've got to work hard. And it's interesting that the word asceticism comes from the Greek askesis. Asceticism, like we use for our, I think there was a question the other day about asceticism. So it comes from the Greek askesis, which is to do with athletic, training to be an athlete. That asceticism is about training. So if you want to win the race, you've got to get fit. You can't, unless you train, you're not going to win the race. So asceticism is about that. It's a training, so that you are taking on those forces of fear, of desire, of territory, of competition, of sexual desire, food, shelter, comfort, and so on. And the Dutanga practices that we have, they're aimed at getting to know those areas, the very basic instinctual areas of our life, so that you get to know, okay, this is what the longing for comfort is like, this is what feeling hungry is like, this is what being cold or being hot, this is what it's like. And so that you're consciously inviting yourself to feel the burn, and athletes talk in that way. Like when you're training yourself, or you're guiding the body towards a level of fitness, you have to sort of pass through those areas where your muscles are really burning, and then that's how the quality of fitness is really developed. It's not because you hate the body. You're not wanting to experience pain, or just thinking that pain is good as an end in itself. And so coming into the monastery, you're not just sort of trying to make life difficult for yourself or create more problems, but it's a training, it's an askesis, so that you are deliberately, consciously, willingly taking that on, so that then you're developing strengths. Just like an athlete, you develop strength in your legs or in your arms or your back or your flexibility, whatever the discipline might be. And so that what we're doing in the monastic training is that ascesis of the heart, of the citta. So you're developing that, say, the ability to say, recognize those instinctual energies, the animal forces within us, and to not be guided by that. So that you might... on the food servery, you might think, "Oh, yeah, I'll have three of those." And think, "Well, wait a minute. There's still another two anagarikas behind me, and all the lay people after them. So maybe I should just take one." So you can think unselfishly, but the feeling is, "Oh, I want all of that. That's for me." And we can recognize that and not hate ourselves for it, but recognize, "Oh, that's the more for me is good feeling," and to know that. And to recognize that and to say, yes, well, that's the more for me is good feeling, duly noted, this is the way it is. And then skillfully leave that aside. And so that's why we train ourselves. And then the result of that is then there's a kind of a delightful feeling in the heart. There's a warmth in the heart, a joyfulness in the heart that comes from being unselfish, from not having followed that greedy or selfish impulse. And then you can see, oh, that's the result of that skillful action, is this sense of joy, and then also the goodwill of the people around you, the people that you left the other goodies for. That, Anagarika Evgenia, she made sure there was one for me. That's very kind of her. She's a good person. But I feel that's one of the great things that I think the Ajahn Chah style of practice, and what he put forth very, very clearly, was acknowledging that sense of what you're taking on. Like I think the other day, one of the questions was about this area, and so sometimes when somebody came to Wat Bapong to ask to practice there, Lumpur Cha would say, "What have you come here for?" And they say, "Oh, I've come here to study with you as a teacher, Lumpur, or I've come here to realize enlightenment." And he'd say, "Well, have you come here to die?" And then, "No, I don't want to die. I don't want to die. I've come here to be enlightened." And he'd say, "Well, it's better if you're here to die," because of that sense of readiness to let go, to be ready to say, transcend the habitual ways of seeing things, your kind of idealism. And rather to meet all the limitations that we experience as human beings, and to die to them, to say that all this is to fear, to desire, to aversion, to selfishness, to jealousy, and so on. So when he's saying, "Have you come here to die?" It's like he's talking to the self-centered habits of the individual, it's to let go of those self-centered ways of thinking, and so that it's and that's a lot more to do with relinquishing and letting go than accumulating. Does that make sense? So maybe just to finish the last paragraph here. "We have this ability to contemplate the nature of things, the ability to say, 'This is the way it is.' We can notice 'the way it is,' quote-unquote, without adopting a personality viewpoint. So, with the breath of the body, its weight, its posture, we're just witnessing and noting, observing how it is now, in this moment. The mood of the mind, whether we feel bright or dull, happy or unhappy, is something we can know, we can witness. And the empty mind, empty of the proliferations about oneself and others, is clarity. It's intelligent and compassionate. The more we really look into the habits we have developed, the clearer things become for us. So we must be willing to suffer, to be bored, and to be miserable and anguished. This is an opportunity to bear with these unpleasant mental states rather than suppress them. Having been born, this is the way it is, at this time, in this place." So again, that Lumpur would emphasize and say underscore that sense of in terms of the meditation, just because you're bored or unhappy or anguished, doesn't mean that the practice is going wrong or that anything is out of order or it shouldn't be that way. But rather, in this moment, if there's a feeling of anguish or a feeling of loneliness, that's what's here, rather than, if only I could get rid of this anguish feeling, or if I could get rid of this doubt, then I could practice, or I shouldn't be feeling dull and lazy. That sense of, here it is, in this moment, here's a feeling of dullness, of being exhausted, or feeling, oh, I can't be bothered. You're right there. That's the thing to know. Rather than looking at that, oh, that's a defilement, an obstacle. I shouldn't feel that I shouldn't be bothered. He's talking about a very, very immediate quality of the practice. So in this moment, here is the I can't be bothered feeling. That's what this is. And you're not saying that it's good or noble or worthy of following, but here it is. This is the I can't be bothered feeling. It's this way. And so that very recognition, that sense of appreciating what's present, that's the liberating quality. Because that which knows the I can't be bothered is actually bothering at that moment. Like that which is aware, oh, this is the I can't be bothered feeling. That there's a choice being made there to be awake and to know that. So that right there, just being ready to acknowledge what's present and to strengthen that quality of knowing. That's the practice. That's the embodiment of the practice. That's the being, the knowing. Not creating an idea around it, but just being that awake, aware quality that is the Buddha refuge. Any further questions, thoughts? Venerable Nidaro, please, microphone, if you can.
Yes, thank you, Ajahn. I was wondering what you were saying earlier about the evolution over so many millions of years of these certain maybe desires and fears and anger, forms of anger and things like that. What do you think if through the practice, if one lets go of some of these very ancient attachments, like the fear of dangerous animals or desire for food, things like that, at the level of brain structure and brain biology, there must be a kind of a rewiring that is happening as well when one lets go of these attachments. That's in a way taking us out of the evolutionary trajectory that all our ancestors have been on for hundreds of millions of years. They have all experienced this particular, let's say, fear of spiders or tigers, and then suddenly the brain, when somebody gets enlightened, is a bit different than that of all our ancestors. So what do you think about kind of actual brain restructuring through the path of liberation? Because that must be happening as well at the same time, no?
Yeah, I'm not an expert on it. It's called neuroplasticity. Right. I'm not an expert on it. But to the degree that I know anything about it, I imagine that's what happens, is really that those parts of the brain that sort of open up the channels to whereby the wisdom faculty and the qualities of mindfulness and awareness, those avenues open up, those neurons kind of multiply and get more developed, and traffic flows more easily down those tracks. And then the reptile brain, the more ancient parts of the brain that control, territory, competition, aggression, and sexual desire, violence, and so forth. That the channels that feed those or that tend to make those active are kind of diminished so that the traffic flows less easily in those areas. I mean, again, I hesitate to say much about it, but it's interesting that the Buddha said way back in his own time that, you know, that which the mind frequently thinks and ponders upon, that becomes the direction of the mind. So, you know, in a way, he's talking about neuroplasticity. He wasn't talking about the actual sort of brain structure, but the more that you think in a particular way, that you know, you do create pathways. So that if you think in ways that are unselfish, non-violent, generous, kindly, wise, then, you know, you develop those pathways. If you think in ways that are selfish, violent, greedy, dishonest, you develop those pathways. Like in it's the Dvaita Vitaka Sutta, Sutta number 19 in the Majjhima, he talks about that. You know, that you, the more you think and dwell upon a particular, in a particular way, that's the track that the mind will follow. It's like a path, like a physical path. If you keep walking up and down the same patch of ground, you make a track in the grass. You know, you that's where you make the path, because you keep walking in that particular place. It's exactly the same with the brain. So if you don't act upon selfish and greedy impulses, that pathway doesn't get developed. You don't go down that track, then it gets overgrown, and it gets less easy for the mind to go down that pathway. And if you develop the track of kindness, generosity, and wisdom, and that's like becomes a sort of six-lane highway, then that's where it's going to be easier for the mind to go. And my understanding is that to a certain degree, the neurophysiology matches that. You know, there's all kinds of people doing experiments and brain scans nowadays that can show these kind of things. And that I know that, say, even like with on more mundane levels, like the brains of London taxi drivers, you can tell that the there actually is a different structure because of having to memorize the entire map of London and all of the complex streets, so that a taxi driver has to memorize all the streets of London. They don't look at a map. They know which is the best way to go. It's called the knowledge. If you look at the brain scan and the brain structures of London taxi drivers, there are certain areas of their brains which are structured differently because of that increased memory function and the sort of spatial orientation of all of the you know, the streets and lanes and one-way systems and whatnot is there in their memory. So there is definitely there are physiological effects that you can, there is that can be recognized. But I wouldn't dwell too much upon that. Those kind of things can be a substantial sidetrack. But I would say that principle that the Buddha speaks about in that sutta, that's exactly the way that it works. And like in the old aphorism, you know, when a pickpocket meets a saint, all they see are pockets. That if that's what you're thinking about is, what can I rob somebody of? You know, if you're a pickpocket, you know, you want to. Then when you meet, if you meet a saint, then you're just looking for where are the pockets? Where can I rob that person of something? You don't see that it's a holy being that might be able to benefit you. So that's the world we see. The world we experience is very strongly conditioned by what we've done with our minds, what we make as a priority. And that if you're always, say, like if you're making fun of people, you're always kind of teasing people or making kind of nasty remarks about other people. I'm not saying that you would, just kind of a random example. So if you're kind of teasing or criticizing people, making nasty remarks about people, then you'll tend to feel that people are making nasty remarks about you and criticizing you. If you don't criticize other people, you don't make nasty remarks about them, and you generate thoughts of respect and loving kindness towards others, then you tend to assume that's how others are thinking of you. At least in my experience, that's how it works. That to a great degree, you know, we create the world that we live in, and that if obviously it's not not completely that way. There's the functionality of the living world, the material world, has its own laws. But to a great extent, the what the mind dwells upon. It's like I remember probably Ajahn Chandasiri remembers from years ago when Lumpur made the comment, say, you're surrounded by fields of merit. Rather, you remember that? It was really interesting because you didn't think, this person's like this and this person's like that. She's this way and he's that way, and you kind of categorize your fellow community members in various ways. And Lumpur just said, you can think of each other as fields of merit. And there was this kind of like, at least I remember. That's how I remember it. It was sort of, you never thought of seeing each other just as kind of fields of blessings, fields of merit. We think of each other in terms of personality or gender or age or place in the community, but being surrounded by fields of merit instead of this personality, that personality, and this one I know, this one I don't know, and this one I like, this one I don't like. And it was really an eye-opener because you can change the world by recognizing your patterns of thinking, and that rather than seeing that things are just in a conditioned and habitual way, you can change the way that you think. So that many of the kind of practices, like the anusatis, the contemplations, like Buddha anusati, Dhamma anusati, and so on. That it's a way of changing your patterns of thinking, like Dhamma, of Marananusati, contemplating death. You're recollecting everyone's going to die. Everyone here in this temple is going to die one day. Absolutely all of us. Guaranteed. So along with thinking, oh look, fields of merit. You think, oh look, dead bodies that are temporarily alive. Really, you can change the way that you think of each other, and then how does that shift the world? Oh my goodness, Tan Nidra is going to die one day. I better be nicer to him, because he could drop dead at any time. So I should be more respectful. I should be kinder. I should be more thoughtful. Or Chaganusati, recollecting your own goodness. Recollecting your own virtues and so on. So those anusatis as a way of cultivating particular patterns of thought, ways of seeing, in order to help the mind break free of its habitual limiting ways of seeing and holding, creating the world. But I see the time has once again gone way past 7 o'clock. Keeps flying by, even though time is an illusion caused by ignorance, it keeps flying by.